They're both rolling? Okay. Today is Sunday, September 25th, 2011. It's the first day of Slichot. And it's a very sad day, a very, very sad day. As I give the shiur, two people will be buried who were killed by the Arabs, Bill Clinton's good friends, on this past Friday. What's even worse is that the Israeli government, army, police covered it up and tried to keep it from public information. I want to dedicate this year. He's an American, from what I understand now. My first report was he was 2 years ahead of my grandson in Bethel. So my grandson, one of my grandsons who studies in Yeshiva at Bethel, knows him very well. And I now learned that he's of American origins. I want to dedicate this year in memory of Asher Palmer and his infant son, Yonatan Hashem Yikom Damo. Again, more Kabbanot falling outside of Hebron. And there's nothing more Jewish than Hebron. And yet our leaders never mention our biblical rights. And I was told why, that they're afraid to turn it into a religious war. What they don't realize is it is a religious war. The worst part is that their car crashed on Friday, both were killed, and the Israeli government let you think it was a car accident. But too many people knew that a tremendous stone was thrown by a passing car, smashing the window, knocking the driver unconscious, and that's why the car sped out of control. At least I want to compliment Bibi Netanyahu that he mentioned the Lubavitcher Rebbe in his talk at the UN. And I'm quoting Bibi now. Here's what the Rebbe said to me. He said to me, you'll be serving in a house of many lives. And then he said, remember that even the darkest place, the light of a single candle can be seen far and wide. And I think we have to at least compliment Bibi on that level, that he quoted the Lubavitcher Rebbe in A Den of Iniquity. One step further, on a lighter note, I just want to say that the book launch on Tuesday caused tremendous comments on all sides, but I just want to deal with a lighter part of it and tell you a beautiful story. The mentioning of Yeruchim Gerelich, so people started telling stories about Yeruchim. So the best story I heard from Simcha Mandelbaum, who swear, and you know, he was in yeshiva in 1950s, Israeli, from the Mandelbaum Gate. If you've heard of the Mandelbaum Gate, that's his home where he was raised. They're two brothers, Moshe and Simcha, from that family. Many other siblings, but these are the two boys. So he told the following story. He came to the yeshiva when he finished the army, May of 1950, and they told him the yeshiva is ending over the summer, but it'll pick up again in Chodesh Elul. In the meantime, he became friendly with people, and he found out there's an Agudat Yisrael convention. And that fall, he went to the Agudat convention, and the Telus Rosh Yeshiva, Mordechai Katz, got up to speak. Not Reb Mordechai Katz, it was his partner, Reb Elyameh Bloch. They were the partners. You know the story. Again, I don't want to spend too much time, but the story is very simple. They were in America fundraising when the war broke out. And because they were here, they were saved. They didn't go back to Europe. Their entire families were wiped out. And they reestablished Telus in Cleveland with all the subsequent history. So Elyameh Bloch got up at the convention. And he had just come back from his first visit to Israel, 1950. And he says, and I quote to you, the halacha, it's based upon a Gemara in Ma'id Katan. You'll find it in the Shulchan Aruch HaRechayim, the last volume, Tav Kuf Samach Aleph. I could lecture on this hours, but it all begins, it's based upon a Gemara in Ma'id Katan. Haroe Are Yehuda B'chur Banan, Omer Are Kadshecha Hayu Midba V'koreya. Wow. So Elyameh said the whole plane ride to Israel, he was debating, should he say this? Is it B'chur Banan? The country's being rebuilt. Does he have to rip Kriya? Where will he be getting off the plane? Is it an isolation? Is there a city? And Rabbi Yemeya describes how the plain lands in Israel, and this is, you know, long before modern tourism, and a girl, a teenage girl, is waiting as they come down the steps, and everyone is given a flower. And Bruchim Habayim L'Medinat Yisrael. And Rabbi Yemeya says, I couldn't rip Kriya. I couldn't. The land is being rebuilt. This young lady gave me a flower that grew in Eretz Yisrael. And instead he said, I bent down and kissed the soil. I was so happy to be there. I read Yeruchim Yerulik gets up and starts shouting at him, you took a flower from a girl. Who gave you permission to take a flower from a girl? You know, Satmar went crazy. There's a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe giving a dollar to a woman, and Satmar was going, and Rebbe Yeruchim says, and all in Yiddish, and but I'm saying it in English, and you criticize me for being in Yeshiva University? Yeshiva University is a bunch of apikorsim, it's a den of iniquity. I'm only there to teach them the proper hashgafa. But don't you dare criticize me again. You took a flower from a girl.
So what is the
okay.
Point of all such a
character? Well, Yitzchak, relax yourself. We'll get there in the Monday class, but a story is a good story, and that story, we can lecture for hours. I'm doing it on Monday. What do you want out of me? I'm not giving lectures on Monday on Zionism. Let me sail into Mizrahi tomorrow, and after that, then I'll go to Jesus.
Tomorrow's
what? Acharam and Mizrahi, you'll understand tomorrow. I'm doing my share, but you have to broaden. You're like my son-in-law. I used to try to give him back issues of Jewish Observer. Muktzum machmas miyus, don't let it into the house. That gentleman's related to my son-in-law. What do you want out of me? But I feel a person has to be broad, has to read, has to know, and has to respond l'tov l'tov. Okay, gentlemen, before I begin today's shiur, I have to give an introduction. But first, let's speak about what we did last week. Very fascinating. We sailed in, you understand, when it comes to changing nusach. Herbie, you daven the Ashkenaz or Sfad? Or Sfad. What nusach do you daven?
I daven Ashkenaz, but the nusach is
Ivrit. The Havaras Svartit. Who gave you permission to change? You grew up in Newark. You lived in Newark.
No, I grew up in a DP camp. And my first teachers were Palestinian Jews.
Okay. And
this is how I was taught.
You're absolutely right. Where did we meet? We met in Newark, in the greater Newark area. Rabbi Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Siegel spoke Svartit when he davened to Ashkenazis.
I don't know.
All the rabbanim. This is an interesting question. I also, I'm like, I do exactly as this gentleman does. I daven in Sfardit, I daven Ashkenazit, but I daven in Sfardit. Now, you see, this is Makom Shenagu. All right, what community do you belong to? And here, there's a tremendous machloket, but as I showed you, Rav Kook was the greatest machmir, Rav Ozia was mekil, Rav Herzog was mekil. No one was Mekil happily. In other words, for Baron Lichtenstein until today, as far as I know, Davins in Havara Ashkenazis makes Kiddush in Havara Ashkenazis. Am I right or wrong? Who learned in the Gush? No? Am I right or wrong? Correct me if I'm wrong. But nevertheless, I'm fairly certain already his grandchildren that live in Israel are Davining Havara Sfaradit. When it comes to marriage, marriage is a lot more than just Makom Shenahagu. When it comes to marriage, there's a question of Shalom Bayit. I have to tell you, I spent the good part of last week and today trying to get a Talmud of mine to give a get. And it's a sad story when you see Shalom Bayit broken up. It's doubly sad when they're children. I'm telling you in advance, those of you who are married, if you have to get divorced, wait until all the children are dead. And then when you're in your 90s or 100, and the rabbi says to you, why did you get divorced at your age? So you'll tell the rabbi, yes, rabbi, I waited. I didn't want to harm my children. I waited till they were gone. All right, if you got to get divorced, do it that way. But make an effort to have Shalom Bayit. Shalom Bayit is very important. I showed you the Rambam in Hilchot Ishus. I told you whenever a couple gets engaged, I always say to them, look up the Rambam, Perek Tetzvah, Halacha Yutet and Chaf. And if we live like that, and I gave lectures on this, and I can't repeat them now. I spent the whole year in trying to work out a happy marriage. It's all on the YU website. It's so important. Make the effort. Compromise. Compromise brings compromise. Decency. Thoughtfulness. What is marriage about? It's gemilut chesed. It's being nice to another human being. And that is so important. And I showed you Reb Moshe Feinstein. Interestingly enough, I just got an interesting question today. Evidently a new volume of Reb Moshe has come out, volume 10. And I got an interesting question which I will deal with, but not now. I know what I want to answer. But I want to see the volume first and see it in print. And Reb Moshe's tshuva with the communist system, with building a mikveh and a shul, that's an overwhelming tshuva. Very powerful. And Reb Moshe, not the slightest that. And look what he's talking about. You're going into a shul where people are going to walk around in their birthday suits. And yet for Shalom Bayit, we have to permit it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted his name erased for Shalom Bayit. So this becomes a big factor with husband and wife. Now, let me introduce it and let me say something very, very important. And follow me carefully, because your minds will not understand me until you think about it for a week, and then you may come back at the end of 49 days and say, Rebbe, you are right. Let me tell you a true story. One time in Machon Gold, and in the 70s, Machon Gold was a tremendous institution at that time. The world was not the way it was today. Today everything is either modern Orthodox, left-wing, right-wing, Haredi, anti-Israel, A-Israeli, A-Zionistic, everyone is labeled. At that time, Machon Gold had Beis Yaakov girls and Flatbush girls and Ramaz girls and Central girls. It was a very balanced crowd. So one time I said to the class, with a straight face, I said, young ladies, I want to give you a marriage proposal. Tell me whether you'll accept it. And I said, imagine you're going out with this boy, Chaim, and you like him and he likes you. And Chaim says to you, and you just heard from Herbie where he was raised, what his first impressions of life are. And the boy says to you, Chana, listen to me carefully. I love you. I want to marry you. But it's after the Holocaust. 6 million Jews were killed. Among them, just think, millions of children, how many Jews we would have been today. And he says to her, I want your permission that I can marry 3 other wives in addition to you, so that we can have so many children and so many grandchildren and replenish the Jewish people. I said, girls, how many of you would accept such a proposal? And you're from girls, you're pious, you're dedicated. How many of you will accept such a proposal? One hand went up. And you should know, it's great heartache for me, because I know the family. She was a balat shuva. She has a brother who's one of the leading people in our Torah community in Eretz Yisrael. And she was, at that time, and it was a passing fancy. This is one of the real problems with Balei Tshuva. They may be serious, but Yiddishkeit has to be taught to them in a way that it takes root. Not a few years later, they say, well, I experimented with Yiddishkeit, now to quote Rabbi Yerucham Gerelik, I'll experiment with drugs, I'll experiment with liquor, I'll experiment with sex, v'shalom al Yisrael. She's no, I often ask her brother, did she ever come back? He says, unfortunately not. She, her hand went up. She would accept the proposal. No, what are you saying? Matan, you're a firm guy. Well, what's wrong with that proposal? It's to me, it sounds wonderful. What's wrong, Chaim? What are you saying? What are you saying? Gentlemen, let me spell it out. Happiness is a function of social, psychological understanding. Let me elaborate and explain it to you very simply. Give you an example, then I want to tie it in with the halacha. One of the greatest gifts Yeshiva University ever got was from Ann Scheiber. A lady named Ann Scheiber left something like $23 million to Stern College. You all know the name. There are scholarships given in her memory. No one knew Ann Scheiber. She lived on the Upper West Side. No rabbi ever recalled meeting her. Her story was unbelievable. She was a lady who never married. She had a very good mind. All she could become was a secretary. She retired in 1946. She got a retirement settlement. She bought Coca-Cola stock. And the rest is history. In the 70s, her lawyer, and she died in her late 90s. In the 1970s, her lawyer brought her a colored television. And he said, Ann, get rid of your black and white. You can afford color. She, what do I need it for? She was happy with black and white. You understand me, Yoni, what I'm trying to say? This was the lifestyle she understood. If I say to you that people were happy with four wives, the wives were happy. It was a different lifestyle. It was a different understanding. The Sephardic world lived like that in two modern times. When we came in Aliyah, a family came in 69 from Persia, from Iran. A man came with two wives, two families, all under one roof. Our only problem was when you invite them to a wedding or a bar mitzvah, how do you address it? The greater family, or do you address rabbi and Mrs.? How do you address it? But you see, your wives, my wives, our world, my female students would not be happy. Today, a woman needs one man, a man needs one woman. The Ashkenazic Jews reached that decision more than 1,000 years ago, as you know, with Rabbeinu Gershom. But it's very important to understand that certain statements that we may quote in the halacha have to be viewed in the context of the sociological, philosophical, psychological setting in which the people lived. And I give you a simple example how careful you have to be. Rav Heschel Schechter, some of you who said they were a student of Rav Heschel. So you know, there was a tremendous storm a few years ago. And I have to tell you, what he was saying was absolutely correct. The problem is when you just quote it in modern times, it's taken out of context. And the Jaffa, the Jewish organization, a feminist, what's it called, Jewish Orthodox Feminist Association, they went berserk. They had ammunition. And what I'm talking about is someone raised the issue, I don't know how the discussion begins, with a ketuvah, what a ketuvah, and Rav Heschel said that it's a meiser kof, that even if they asked if a woman can write a ketuvah, so he answered that a ketuvah has no inherent kedusha. And he used the rabbinic expression, Maisakov, even a monkey can write a ketuvah. I don't have to tell you, the feminists went around saying that Rav Heschel said, women are like monkeys. Now, yeah, excuse me?
What you thinking?
He would, God forbid, he meant Maisakov. My daughter writes ketuvah, she's a calligraphy artist. Please, Yitzchak.
You know, the trouble is, we have too much respect for scholarship, and we forget that a person's mouth can be his downfall.
Okay, besides that, Chazal already said that. You're absolutely right. If a man has a
PhD in mathematics, you wouldn't show him the color that a person is a gogo in the knowledge of Torah.
But this is an innocent mistake. This is not shoot the prime minister or whatever happened there. This is an innocent mistake. Okay, all this becomes very important because we're going to deal with tshuva mainly from the Sephardic world. These questions of one minhag do not come up in two modern times. In two modern times, we in the Ashkenazic world did not intermarry ethnically. Sephardim and Ashkenazim didn't meet, but in the Sephardic world, where there were so many different minhagim, That's where we will see these questions. Now, as far as I know, and I say as far as I know, because you can never be certain with responsible literature, you never know what will be found tomorrow in some Geniza. As far as I know, the first person to deal with this problem was the Rashbetz, Reb Shimon ben Tzedek Duran, the person who authored Tashbetz, Tshuvat Shimon ben Tzemach Duran. And what happened here? What happened here was very simple. He was part of the first expulsion from Spain in 1391. They started to tell the Jews, either you convert or you will be killed. I don't have to tell you how many Jews suffered in the Inquisition and what went on until modern times with the Inquisition. It could very well be that the United States of America only has a powerful Jewish community because Jews ran away to America so many hundred years ago to avoid persecution under the greater aegis of Spain and Portugal. Now, when Jews ran away, they ran away from many different communities. And here in Algiers, you had an ingathering of exiles. And everyone had different minhagim. And for the first time, you face the problem, what do a husband and wife do if they have different minhagim? And remember, these are refugees. They're coming, little knowledge, few rabbis. Ingathering of the exiles, to a certain degree, it's like the United States, New York City, 1870, 1880, Jews are pouring in from Galicia, from Hungary, from Poland, from Lithuania, from White Russia, from the Ukraine, from Germany. There are very few rabbis there. And there is such a mix-up of culture, of custom. And here you have the first time in the Tashbetz, Chelek Gimel, Tshuva Mispa Kuf Ayin Tet. Now, to the best of my knowledge, we don't have an edited edition of the Tashbetz, but I'm quoting from a nice version that was printed in Lemberg over 100, and if I look at this, it's about 110 years ago. And it's already in rabbinic type. It's not in the old-fashioned writing where they combine letters and you have to really work hard to read it. And here he deals with it. And he tells the story that a man from one kehila married a woman from another kehila. Their minhagim are different. Who does she follow? And here he sets down the basic law, she must follow the husband. The husband is the head of the house, the head of the community. He now sets the spiritual tone. She has to follow him. Okay, there has to be one minhag. How are you going to have one house, two different minhagim? The Engbo Sofek, Shaloye Shnayim Subim al Shulchan Echad, Chalukin, be Isotote Hamar Sulazer, Hamutha Lazer. And he gives us this dramatic description. Imagine you're Hungarian, you're Makpid on Galat Kosher. Imagine your wife is Lithuanian. In Litha, I was told by great Rabbanim, including my own Rebbe, Maria Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, no one ever heard of the word glatt kosher. And here, she's eating regular kosher, and you're looking at her as if she's a goya, a sinner, and you're being makpid on glatt kosher. You have to admit that a situation like this leads to animosity, leads to enmity. It's one family, one set of dishes, one house. And that's the way he postens. Now he goes one step further. And here we have to deal with something again, and has to be seen in context. Gentlemen, I can quote Rabbi Belkin. Rabbi Belkin always used to say, no one has a mortgage on the Ribbono Shel Olam. In other words, the new year is beginning, we wish ourselves well, all of us want long life and happiness. We don't know what the future holds for us. When I went to Yeshiva Salanta, elementary yeshiva, there were a number of kids in the school whose mothers were really their aunts. You know what I'm talking about? There was a much higher death rate, lower lengthening in childbirth. People didn't live that long. Medicine was not as perfected as today. There was a minhag in the Ashkenazi community if a woman died young and left little children, if she had a younger sister, the husband married the younger sister, because the feeling was that an aunt would raise nieces and nephews like her own children, filled with love. And generally it worked, Zach, 100%. Now, people died. You had chlitza. Today you rarely, rarely hear about chlitza. When I was growing up, occasionally we had a chlitza in the yeshiva. By the way, Yitzchak, you want to come in for Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelich on chlitza? You remember of Shmuel Gerstenfeld? Remember the Beis Din in the yeshiva? Later it becomes the RCA Beis Din. So one time there was chlitza, and the older fellows were invited in to see it. And the guy who was giving chlitza was a total guy. He didn't know a thing about Yiddishkeit, but his sister-in-law pleaded with him and paid him off. So he came, he did the chlitza. Now how does the chlitza end? He has the spy in front of her, right or wrong. And he walked out and he turned around, I'll never forget this, and he spat at the Beis Din. You follow? When he was finished already, he spat at the Beis Din. Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelich got up and shared, the man was a genius. And you know what Yeruchim said? When Yiddishkeit fangt an mit Speierei, when Yiddishkeit begins with spitting, he concluded that this is what Yiddishkeit is about, you spit. So he walked out and spat at the Dayanim. It's not a bad verb. Think about it. So you see, part of the question that he has to deal with here that you never will see in modern times, what happens if the husband dies young? And let's put it into words. Here is a lady who never ate legumes on Pesach. How many of you are Sfadim? Eidot HaMizrach, real Sfadim. You know that among the Sfadim, there are various customs. Some eat legumes, some don't eat legumes. Some eat these legumes, don't eat other legumes. We're going to discuss legumes in a little bit more detail, probably today. But she didn't eat legumes. She marries her husband, and the husband eats legumes. What happens after he dies? And she's been eating legumes from time immemorial. And she started because she married him. At the age of 40, lo aleinu, he dies. No, give me a simple logical answer. Right in the Torah. A kohen, truma, exactly. If she has children from her husband, the kohen, she continues to eat legumes. If she doesn't have children, she goes back to her father's tradition, and she can no longer eat legumes. The marriage is severed, the marriage has ended, the man has died, there is no zera, and if there's no zera, then she no longer can take on the kulat of the husband. You see, this is Danny, you with me? Daniel, you with me? This is, I'm still shaking when I think of your half-sister. I mean, this is to me. Did you send my regards?
Not yet.
Not yet. Let's see if she remembers her Rebbe, okay? Well, what's the bet? What do you think?
She'll remember.
All right, I hope you're right. But But you understand this question? You wouldn't have it today. Because today, Baruch Hashem, we take for granted, although I have to tell you, as you saw from the newspapers last weekend and Yediot, about this couple that came in Aliyah from America where the lady is critically ill with cancer, a young lady with a little baby, and never, she wanted, she says, her greatest wish was to become an Israeli citizen, and if she's going to die al Admat HaKodesh. I mean, such Ahmad Yisrael, what a beautiful generation we raised. We have to be proud. We have problems, but what a beautiful generation. What Mesirat Nefesh. What love of Eretz Yisrael. It's beyond words. So you see, we don't ask this question today, but here it is. Now, he goes into a side issue, which you will face in the rabbinate. Those of you going into the rabbinate, this is an issue that will come up. My dear students, a lady is married. Fine. Lo aleinu, she dies. It's all in the children. Who do you bury her next to? Her father or her husband? Her father's family plot? Or her husband's family plot? Who do you bury her next to? Very fascinating question. Can anyone tell me what is Minhag Yisrael? What is Minhag Yisrael? A woman has had two husbands. Husband number one, he died at 50. Husband number two, he died at 100. She was married to each one for 25 years. Okay. So Minhag Yisrael is, and he brings it down, it follows who you have children with. If that's the case, it's an exact proof that we follow the concept of Truma, we follow the concept of Kitniyot, children, she's still part of that community. If there are no children, she's not part of that community. She bounces back to her father's community. Fascinating. But he raises a side issue, which is also in the halakha. What about if she left the world and she says, after 120 years, I want to be buried next to my father and mother. My last day in New York, right after Hurricane Irene ended. So we had a lot of invitations. A lot of Talmidim wanted to take us out, but I told him I have to go. It's an elderly rabbi in his mid-80s, and it meant a lot to him that he could take us out, he and his wife. And he's Efreitzach, he was so happy. He just brought his father from Philadelphia to be buried right next to him in Beit Shemesh, in the American cemetery. And he was so happy. You can't believe he just had the reburial. And he was telling me, he knows about the burial and reburial. That must have been an undertaker in addition to being a rabbi. So he knows. And he's telling me how his father's body was found intact. And his father was killed in Philadelphia. He was a sheikhet. Yerushalmi sheikhet came after World War I. And he was in a car. They were coming back from the Shlachtoys. And a car with building material hit a rock. And it bumped into the air. And building cinders went flying. And one landed right where he was sitting in the car and killed him on the spot. His father was he was maybe 7-8 years old. He was so happy. No, what if the woman says, I have 10 children with my husband. I loved my husband. My husband was a good man. My husband learned Torah every day. My husband never missed a minyan. She's praising her husband to the world. But I want to be buried next to my mother and father. And you know something? We listen to her. And it doesn't contradict this principle, because there's a concept of Keva Avot. You see that in the Nevi'im. Whenever you learn Navi, that they took the king, they buried him in the sepulcher of his family. There's a concept of a family cemetery. You find in your day, I mean, these are not happy halachot, but the whole concept of removing a body, reburying a body. So one of the factors that will add to the heter is the concept of keva avad. It evidently brings nachat ruach to the person who died, that he's back with his blood family. So you see, these are interesting questions. It's not black and white, because it's not that the Gemara discussed it. There's more minhag involved than basic halacha. But prima facie, the concept of minhag Yisrael, that you're buried next to the man with whom you had children, this concept does follow truma and is what we say about kinyan on Pesach.
You had two husbands and you had children who were both.
But then it's a fieldless choice. I've been asked that question many times. Achronim discuss it. Some want to say with whom she had more children. Some want to say with whom she lived more years. But it's up to her. It's a fieldless choice. If she left no tzavah, then obviously if it's the second husband and he's alive yet and he will insist that she be buried where he's going to be buried, you have to listen to him. I can only tell you, I had one experience. And my neighbor, my revered neighbor, Rabbi Yehoshua Hutner, so I mean, we were neighbors for 40 years, and he died at 98. So he was married to two, I didn't know his first wife, she died in 67, if I'm not mistaken. He was married to two very strong women, you know. You could see this was a man who respected women. Then when I read about who his grandmother was, that she was the Ashishuk Rebbetzin and ran the city, I understand already where his respect for women came. So his first wife was Skan Menachel Klali of the Misrach HaPnim. She was a Chassidic Rebbe's daughter. She was a niece to the Pechechna, to the Esh Kodesh. And she died young, I believe. I think it was cancer. So they made a shidduch for him with one of the great women I knew in my life, in Yitzchak Numa, Batsheva Zib Soloveitchik Hutner, Reb Shmuel Soloveitchik's widow. And they married in 68. Our building was built in 69, and we all moved in together. And he left at Tzavah that I remember at her funeral, he said that this is where he's going to be buried. He never met such a tzaddikin as his second wife. And it's interesting because he had no children with her, but he had one daughter with the first wife. But no one questioned it, that this was his will, this was his wish. All right, he went against Minhag Yisrael, but evidently there were reasons that he said what he said, and it was very moving because he said everyone knew she was a tzaddikin, she was a mamumet, she was a very special isha gedolah. And there, with my own ears, I heard him say, and that's where he was buried, exactly next to her.
Question. Yeah. In the case that he raises, that she did not have children.
Right.
And then she would revert back to her father's. Let's say she got used to the minhag of her husband, she was married for 10, 15 years, and she wants to maintain it.
You're asking a wonderful question, and we will come to it much later. But what you're asking is exactly why I introduced what I said about the four wives. At this period, a woman was perfectly happy to be an appendix to her husband, an adjunct. You follow? And she was perfectly happy. And if he died, she goes back to her father. This was the mindset. So this question doesn't come up. But I'll show you with a modern Sfatic Posek where you'll see this thinking comes to the fore. And he was very different from David Halevi of Tel Aviv. Yeah, who I knew. I taught his daughter Nitzvia. He's dealing already with a liberated woman, with the women that our wives are. You understand? There would probably plenty of room to Paskin that when she became a member of this Kehillah and she likes it, she's part of it, and Rav Avadya would be overjoyed to say it because he feels that the Meridiatra, you know, Rabbi Yosef Karo, etc. But the sensitivity of Rav David HaLevi is indicative of the man. He was very, very different. Now, I just want to add on one more part to the tshuva. He doesn't miss a beat. The Tashbetz, of course, was. How many of you have dealt with the Tashbetz? You know where you deal with the Tashbetz, where it becomes extremely important. Kufman Malif, Kufman Bet, Kufman Gimel, Kufman Dalin. No, who's going into the Rabner here? Who's going into Chinuch here? No. You going to take a salary? Why are you're allowed to take a salary for teaching Torah? To be a Dayan? To be a Rav? To Paskin Shiloh? You're not familiar with the Rambam in Pirkei Avot? Kol Oser Torato Kadam Lach Popo? Oh my gosh. The Rambam? Chil Hashem? The Tashbetz has, I recall, four tshuva dealing with it. And, you know, he permits it. That you're taking schar, you could be doing something else, you could be a computer programmer, you could be a professor, so you're taking schar batala. And of course, in teaching, if you're teaching young kids, you're a shomer kishuyim, you're a ganenet, whatever you want to call it. But that's the tashbetz. That's for rabbis. That's the most famous tashbetz. But he raises another problem at the end. All this is very good and fine when we're dealing with death. What about if they got divorced? The man threw her out. He wants no part of her. She wants no part of him. I have to tell you, I'm still, as old as I am, and as much as I've experienced in life, it's still shocking to me to see a man and woman who loved each other, were intimate with each other, to see all the hatred and enmity and what comes out in many divorces. Hashem Yirachem. If you would know what I've gone through these last few days and the advice I've given, I hope you would be proud of me. But how does it happen? I don't know. I'm a romanticist. I'm a bad example to follow. I believe in love. I believe in respect. I believe, wow, your wife, I can quote Chazal to you one after another. What we owe to our women, Shaliva Shalah.
The Yankees
this year surprised us all. Halavai, wow, man. The Yankees, but look at Rodriguez. Look, 20 once he's getting $23 million a year. Yeah. Ribbono Shel Olam, for every home run he hit, he's getting $1,200,000. He has my initials, Zichlig and Dred, financially, and he's on top of the world. What can you do? No, what about a divorce? What about a get? So the Tashbetz says it's exactly like death. It has nothing to do with hatred and enmity. It has nothing to do with it saying, get the hell out of my house. I don't want you. It has nothing to do with her yelling and shouting, you maneuver, you icewaff, you trumpetic, you bum. You why you guy, get the heck out of here. I don't want to look at you again. Let me run to Lakewood and Gary Bells, etc. Gentlemen, nothing to do with that. Does she have children or doesn't she have children? If she has children, she is still a part of that community. If she doesn't have children, she's out of the community. Fascinating. That's the Tashbetz. I have to tell you, we'll see a number of other tshuvot written throughout the ages. Not many tshuvot. This becomes a flood in modern times for one simple reason. It's what I mentioned before. There was very little inter-ethnic marriage. The Pailisha remained with the Pailisha. The Yungarisha remained with the Yungarisha. The Litvisha with the Litvisha. Even if they intermarried, it was all Ashkenazim. The Sfadim were in a different world. In modern times, we are all thrown into one cauldron. In modern times, the greatest miracle of the state of Israel is inter-ethnic marriage. The Haredi world has a tremendous blemish on its record. And it looks down at inter-ethnic marriage. Could you imagine a Sfadik Rosh Yeshiva he's married to the Rambam's daughter, and he offers you his daughter, and you turn away and say, she's nicht vom unserer, she's not one of us. That is a chilul Hashem to the second power. In the circles in which I live, it is beautiful to see the second, third, fourth generation, Lalat Mata Kodesh, we are all one. Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. Take a look at the best-selling book, Halavai, from Washington Avenue to Washington Avenue. You should sell 1/10 of the amount of books that Rabbi Chaim Sabato interviewed Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. It is a bestseller in Israel today. And think for a moment, two totally different worlds. No, they once were two totally different worlds. It is one world today. This is the Tashbetz. In modern times, we have these questions. Throughout the millennium, it was rare. It's like Geirut. If you turn to the question of Geirut, there were almost no shilas ever asked about Geirut. Why, Chaim? Why weren't there shilas? If someone converted, he was risking his life. Who was burned at the stake second day Shavuot? No, tell me who. Reb Avram ben Avraham, Count Polotsky, the Vilna Gaon's best friend, the famous convert, buried next to the Gaon, and Nebuch, the communist, uprooted the whole cemetery. His only the Gaon's cavern, Reb Chaim Moisa, they allowed to rebury. Reb Avram Ager is gone. If you converted, you meant it. In modern times, no, Marilyn Monroe was Jewish. I think Elizabeth Taylor was Jewish. They can be right or wrong. I don't know what type of Jew, what type of conversion. But just think for a minute, modern times, conversion, well, of course, what, big deal. Today we have thousands of shilas. Michael Weissman. Michael Weissman. I know the name, let me get the face. Moshe Schwartz. Excuse me? Not here. Matan Eder, I know. Moshe Raps. Yoni Miller. And he worked with Sanel Fishman. Chaim Bash. Did you call my daughter? Got a call and asked. She told me. Daniel Lowenstein. Moshe Lester. Eliyahu. Is there anyone here? No, that's it. Okay. Okay. Michael Weissman. Okay, let me go further. Noam. What is Noam? Let me just remember, I spoke with you last week about Tchumim in the Sunday class. The forerunner to Tchumim.
What number was that called?
Tchumim, I can tell you in 1 second. Tetvav, 1995. The forerunner to Tchumim was Noam. A few words about the founder and the whole idea behind it. Vayakam da chadash shalaya dat Yosef. One of the greatest names when I was growing up was Harav Menachem Kasher. How many of you familiar with this Torah Shlema? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Rav Menachem Kasher, these are Jews who Michael knew everything. If there ever was a wise man, it was Reb Menachem Kasher. He was a Gerach Chassid, a Pelisha, photographic memory, and a very organized mind. Moshe, he lived in America for many formative years. If you have an Erev in Manhattan today, are you aware, Moshe, that the Erev was in the big news over the weekend on the East Side? It seems he got cut and they couldn't let them fix it. Because Obama was there, the UN was there, the police, it was an emergency area. I don't know whether or not there was an area in Manhattan this past Shabbos, but I know it's on Friday there was a lot of tension. Moshe, he wrote endless volumes why Manhattan can have an area. Yoni, more than that, you talk about the international dateline. I don't think anyone in modern times wrote more on the Dateline than Rav Kasha, and I have to say his viewpoint on the Dateline has basically been accepted. La halacha u'maisa. I don't want to go into it now, but essentially what he was saying is there really is no Dateline. It has to deal with where you are. B'chol moshvotechem. And I pass in la halacha that way. When anyone ever asks me they're crossing the Dateline, I say the first week you can be machmir and keep 2 days, 1 day. But the day of the local community is a deoraita. The second day, you can do malacha, which is not deoraita, but nothing deoraita, it's chumrah. But after that, you're a member of the local community. And it's a fascinating question. I lectured on it for many months, quite a few years ago. But in order to deal with the Dateline, you have to have a mind like Rav Menachem Kasha. He could understand it and really comprehend it. He was a great individual. In addition to being a Lamdan Mufak and being a Gera Chassid, he was the greatest religious Zionist of our times. All of you know, we'll come to it in the other class, he wrote the response to the Satmar Rebbe, HaTkufa HaGadolah, and he sensed that in Israel, and he lived in Yerushalayim already after the founding of the state, and I had the zechut to meet with him twice. He wouldn't talk with anyone, he was too busy, but twice I was able to speak with him, and it was just unbelievable to deal with this man and his outlook and his depth of understanding. So we understood that in the state of Israel, you're going to have problems that you never had before. It's an ingathering of the exiles, it's the building of the country. He understood the army, the police force, kashrut in the public domain. You're going to have questions, geira to the family purity, tarat mishpacha, family pedigree. We're going to have problems we never dreamt about before. And Asanel, he came up with the idea of having a rabbinic journal devoted to these problems. And that's what we call Noam. Now, Noam, ultimately, with Rav Kasha's demise, Noam disappeared a few years later. Tchumim took over what Noam began. You understand? It's the same thrust to deal with She'elot LaHalacha that deal with the state of Israel. Moshe Laster. Moshe. I'm quoting from Noam Chaf Gimel. And I'm beginning on page Kuf Nun Chet. And I'll show you what's very fascinating here. And he's giving a review of the questions dealing with this interethnic marriage. And he says, after the Tashbates, we do not find questions about this. Tashbates was accepted, la halacha, this is the way to go. But in the 1700s in Yerushalayim, for the first time, you had various families coming in and eating of rice on Pesach became a big problem. Some ate and some didn't eat. Now, what I'm about to quote from is very important because no one can understand why don't we eat rice on Pesach? After all, the Gemara says openly in Pesachim that you can cook rice and definitely it ferments and ferments. Have you ever cooked rice and it boils over? But it's not chametz. And one of the most important concepts that you have to have is that the concept of chametz is not a concept of science. It's not fermentation. Chametz, Moshe, is defined by Chazal, the five types of grain, 18 minutes in water, that is chametz. Not to be confused with fermentation. You follow me? Rice ferments. So Ribbono Shel Olam, an open Gemara. I mean, if it's an open Gemara, Moshe raps as a frum guy, and he wraps it out. If it's an open Gemara, why can't I eat rice on Pesach? Michael, so much has been written. Why can't we eat rice? And here, he goes in to the whole question. And have any of you ever cleaned rice before Pesach? No, you're all Ashkenazim. In this room, Aaron Rakefet is a master rice cleaner before Pesach. Why is Aaron Rakefet a master rice cleaner? Because the Israeli army, Tzahal, in those years served rice on Pesach, and they would call up the entire rabbinate. And I can tell you exactly how to clean rice. You put on a white tablecloth, you pour out a few kilo, and you move it along and you move it along. If you see anything that's black, not white, you remove it. Well, what are you kosher it for? Very simple. Have you ever been on fields? Rice is grown on this field. On the next field, they're growing wheat. They're growing barley. The winds come along. They can very well blow barley and wheat into the rice. All right. So Moshe, who last was learning about beetle of Shishim, says, no, what's the big deal? So the lady cooks the rice. It's batel b'shishim, right or wrong? There's only one problem on Pesach. We come, it says mashahu, not kol shahu, but mashahu. But I guess it means the same thing. All right? This is the problem. Now, so now come along and Michael Wiseman be wise and say, what's the big deal? Let's clean out the rice before Pesach. Zach, it is tedious work. It is hard. Has your mother ever asked you to polish furniture? And then she comes by and says, you didn't polish here, you didn't polish here. Clean off the window. You know, a man does a half-hearted job. A woman does a terrific, sincere, complete job. It is very difficult. So because of the fear, and because of the chametz on Pesach, people did not eat rice. That's one reason. I have to tell you, the Israeli army had a very easy solution. The rice was cleaned, and if you talk with Moroccan women, they'll tell you they have a minhag to clean it three different times. In the Israeli army, the rice was cleaned, and then, Daniel, it was cooked. If it's cooked before Pesach, it's batel b'shishim. So you cooked it and put it in the freezer. And you should know, with all the hechsherim they give across the world, with oils, and I'm not even talking about legumes, but regular oils, who knows what type of containers they're shipped in. But one thing is for sure, it's all manufactured before Pesach. So if there ever was a shayla, it's batel b'shishim. So you can solve the problem, batel b'shishim, but you have to admit it's difficult and it's tedious, and we can get along without rice for a week. Fine. That's one reason. That's one reason that he gives. By the way, I'm quoting here from a tshuva from the Admat Kodesh by Pinchas Yosef Mizrahi. I'm quoting from Chelik Bet, Hashmatat Orechayim Simon Bet, page 116, column 3, in the actual tshuva. I saw the tshuva, but I'm quoting it from Noam, because the print is legible, and the print in the tshuva is that rabbinic script that's very, very hard to read.
So his name is Pinchas what?
Pinchas Yosef Mizrahi. Arab Pinchas Yosef Mizrahi, Atmat Kodesh, Chelik Bet, Hashmatat, it's where he redoes Arachayim the second time, Simon Bet, page 116, column 3. It's a folio, you understand? Column A, B, other side, C, D. And very fascinating, because he's actually giving reasons why you can't use legumes on Pesach.
What does that have to do with that thing?
No, I'll show you the question in a second. The question is very, very fascinating. But I want to explain the legumes first. He gives a second reason. And by the way, these reasons are brought down by the Achronim. I've never seen any other reason that really makes sense. Gives a second reason, that people make bread out of rice. I don't know if you see it today. Today you see rice cakes, rice patties. I actually remember as a kid there was rice bread. And what they were worried about, if you can make bread out of rice, they'll think you can make bread out of wheat or barley, chamesha chaminim. They'll make that mistake. To me, that's a very weak reason, because we used to have cornbread. I mean, people know it's corn. People know it's rice. But they were worried that they would think you can make any type of bread you want for Pesach. Fine. What's the question? Fascinating question. Reuven, all his life, ate rice on Pesach. After Sheva B'dikot, he checked very carefully. And there was no chash chametz. And all his children following his tradition. And his son Reuven, the son of Reuven, met a girl, a daughter of Talmidei Chachamim, Chassidim, big yichus. Father is a Kohen, and Reuven, the son of Reuven, wants to continue eating rice. All his life he ate rice. He was raised in a home. They ate rice. You know that people who love rice in Eretz Yisrael, Svadim don't consider a meal without rice, right or wrong. How many times, wherever I've been, they serve rice. I don't know, I'm not crazy about rice, but they love it, they love it. Okay, fine. The ish tozot not ketet soreret umiyana bedavah. And this woman, from woman, pious woman, she refuses. And she tells him, my father never ate rice. No one in the family ever ate rice. I refuse to eat rice. And her husband says, you're wrong. You have to eat rice. You have to let me eat rice. I give you your bread. I give you your clothes. I give you she drinks out of kid. I supply your drinks. And the Efsheh Babayat Echad Ben Hog Shnei Ben Hakim. Now I want to be Malamed Zchut in the woman. And I want to tell you, Michael, please sit here tomorrow, okay? Because you're shorter than most. I don't have the strength to see you. I come from a family, all my grandsons are 6'8". One grandson's 6'6", 6'4", 6'6". Don't ask. And the grandson who's 6'6", his father's shorter than me. My other son-in-law is 6'4", 6'3", but it's unbelievable. And he's 5', I'm 5', I was 5'10 in my prime. Great, great. Wow, that's what I love, a student who reads the Rebbe's mind. Are you taking notes or no, take notes, don't sit there. Because what I'm gonna tell you a little story now. I just want to illustrate it so you should understand the way this woman feels. You shouldn't dismiss her and say, what chutzpah? So let me tell you a little story. I'm married. It's 51 years ago, right? 51, Pesach now. So we go to my in-laws for the Seder. And I broke matzah into the soup. My mother-in-law, Zichrono Tzadeket Levracha, looked at me like I was a rotten, vicious shaker. She was furious. And I looked at her, I'm a Litvisher, I'm a Talmud of the Rav, I was a hot shot then, halavai, I mean today I'm a nobody. Then I was, you know, a big shot in yeshiva. And wow, and I knew how to learn, and I'm looking. And the Vilna Gaon insisted, looking to Maisa Rab, he insisted on having Kneid Lach Leil HaSeder. Right or wrong? No, right or wrong? What do you say, Moshe? Right or wrong? Absolutely, Leil HaSeder insisted, Nisanel insisted on having Kneid Lach. And my mother-in-law wanted it. My wife told me, if you ever do that again, you're finished. You're finished. She would probably ask the Shaila with the dishes afterwards. Matan, you have to understand, people are raised with certain concepts. Not everyone is a Lamed. Not everyone is a Talmud Chacham. My mother was raised in Chassidish home. Her parents were Mishpatz Chassidim. My father-in-law was a Belza Yingel in his youth, with payas in the works in Europe, Vienna. Belza. It's their mentality. So this woman is looking at her husband, what kind of shaykhs did I marry? I don't know. Who's married here? I'll give your opinion to you, Danny, here. So it's like you and your wife. Your wife doesn't eat kosher gelatin and you do. And she looks at you like you're in ice spots. So you tell her Rabbi Soloveitchik was mater and Rabbi Chaim Moiser was mater. She's looking at you. Big deal. I don't eat kosher gelatin either. She said, I know it was mater. But all right, I have a chumra. I'm entitled to a chumra. So you know the Mishnah in Ediyot, Rabbi Yossi Ashari, it's not good to be machmor, but not good to be mekil. So it's a very interesting shayla. And he answers, absolutely, she has to follow her husband. And here's the words he uses. And again, I take you back to my introduction of more than an hour ago. If you would use these words in modern times, there are many women, Daniel, many women would get upset, you understand? And really call you a lower esteem. They would really be upset. But you have to understand, in the context of that world, of that mentality, and I quote, and again, I don't take me out of context, I'm quoting a tshuva from the 1700s. Kivin sheisha rushut ba'ala aleha ukfufa tachtav v'yim ken yesh lo mincha kukulei beit ha'bal dafka. The lokim chum chumre beit aviha, the al tishaneh mipnei hamachloket. And he's saying very simply, the husband sets the spiritual tone for the family. She is subject to him. He is the master of the house, the master of the kingdom. Call it what you wish. Okay, you remember there's a honeymoon is like this where Ralph Camden is making a whole talking about he's the master of the kingdom, the master of the house, and his wife isn't there. When she walks in, suddenly the deck of cards collapses. But in this society, and she has to take not the chumras of her father, but the kulat of her husband. And even if she wants to remain from it, she wants to be machmir, and she thinks it is Hasidish to be machmir, she's not allowed. And the Baal can force her, lahakel kamoho, b'chol hamaseh sheyaseh, kein aseh taseh gam hi, v'ein alecha shum chet. And there's no sin involved.
Who is the author?
This is the Tshuva I'm quoting from Mizrahi, from Reb Pinchas Yosef Mizrahi. And you follow? There's be one minig in the house. He sets the tone. He sets the spiritual tone. And the Rishut Bala Aleha. I mean, today's women, I just spoke with a student of mine. She says, I will not call my husband my Baal. Ishi. Not say Baal. Baal implies she is, I don't know, subject to him. Chas v'chalila, she uses the word ishi. You follow? Not Baal, Masanel. Ishi. Wow. But this is the context. 1700s. Okay. Now, here he makes a very interesting point. The Taj Bates gave a similar answer. But the Taj Bates views it There has to be shalom bayit. There has to be one way to go. You can't have gelatin and non-gelatin on one table. He makes a different point. He ties it entirely in, not with shalom bayit. Makom shenahagu. She grew up in her father's house. She has now moved into her husband's house. It's ein daitol machzar. It's like coming an aliyah. I remember in 69 we had an exact situation like this year. Maybe it was 70, with exactly like this. You have to check the calendar. But I remember we had one of my early years here, we had 3 days in a row Yom Tov. Very rare in Israel. And then Sukkot was coming. And we had a neighbor, I mentioned his name, Yitzchak Feiler, should live and be well. He was a 58 Yeshiva College graduate a year before me. And Yitzchak, very frum guy. And I remember he says to me, Ani, you're going to observe only one day Yom Tov this year? I said, absolutely. He said, I can't do it. All my life I've observed 2 days. Idiot. You're living in Israel. Ain't that all outside? You came in Aliyah. You're a member of a new community. You follow if you take the point of view, like the Shulchan Aruch or Rav Moshe Feinstein, that Yom Tov Sheni goes with the community you belong to. All right, you're coming Aliyah, you've changed your community. You move from New York, Moshe, you raps, you move from New York to Cleveland. You've changed your community. Maybe you have different minhagim in Cleveland than we had in Brooklyn or Bronx or Manhattan, you follow me? So if I'm there, I'm there. 30 days in Cleveland, ain't I tolaxa, I'm a member of the Cleveland community and I have to follow whatever Rabbi Blau and then Rabbi Joel tell me. Right or wrong? Same thing here. Very interesting. In your father's house, it's one makom. Your husband's house, it's a second makom. Ve'ein daito makzar. Halacha, you now take your husband's minhagim. Now, this tshuva conquered the world. And all the Sephardic poskim who came after Rav Mizrahi, paskim lahalacha, mishenaha glechol oros bepesach, velakach isha she'ena rotze lechol, mishum shekach haita noheget bevet avia, yachol lekofa shetochal gam hi oros kamoho. You're going to force feed her. No? What do you think, Danny? You could get away with that today? You'll see, Rav David HaLevi has such sensitivity. He says, so what does it bother you if your wife has a chum? You understand? What does it bother you if your wife has a chum? I don't know. It wouldn't bother me. That's all I can tell you.
Dangerous for children.
I want to tell you something. This is, you're touching upon a very interesting point. You don't even realize what you're saying, Yoni. Let me give you your opinion now and spell it out, okay? What you're touching upon is it good to teach a little kid Kitzur Shulchan Aruch? You follow me? Rabbi Aaron Lichtin has raised this question. I mean, I've raised it, but why? If I say I raised it, I'm a lightweight, but Rabbi Aaron has raised this question. You follow me in the Sanhedrin? You don't have to go fishing very far. It's a very fascinating question. So you see, on one hand, what did I talk about the other night? I spoke about the framework of the picture. Everyone paints their own picture, but halacha, to me, is the frame, and we cannot transgress. The picture is individualistic, but the frame is the Baha Hashem Zuh halacha. Not everyone agrees with me. It's amazing. Everyone says, why you went very right, but you see, a counter-reaction is very left. I can only tell you that I look at my Rebbe every day. I listen to his voice, and I have to look the Rebbe in the eye. And boy, I cannot look the Rav in the eye if I would say that partnership minyan is acceptable. That's all I can say. But it's very important to give a kid that frame. On the other hand, willy-nilly, you're giving a youngster a feeling there's one way to go, only one way. And you know, halacha is not like that. You're learning your Adaya, you're learning Orach Chaim. I mean, you know right away, you listen to a sheikh here, listen to me for 20 years and you'll see halacha is not monolithic. Sure, there's a frame, there's the Oraita, there's the Rabbanon, there's Yesh Omrim, and you have to be able to understand, let a kid feel that we have plenty of choice. We're not going to parcel out a Litvak or a Chassid or a Yeki, and there's so much choice. But then you come back to the question again, is it healthy for a kid to feel there's so much choice? And this is a very delicate question. In my own way of thinking, I always taught my children, this is what we do, but there's ample halakhic discussion that may lead to a different conclusion. I always taught them that. And I don't know, I succeeded. And we've had hard times, I have to tell you, the Rabbi Alon scandal. I hope it's not true. One of my grandsons just gave me a terrific argument over Shabbos about Rabbi Alon. And I told him Rabbi Lichtenstein wouldn't come out. And my grandson, we've suffered. But nevertheless, the kids remain solid. One daughter tells me, she's a Chabakuk. She taught me that word, Chabakuk. You know what that stands for? Chabad, Breslov, Cook, and Kalbach. Okay, as long as the frame is there, let her be a Chabakuk. But the frame has to be there. So it's an interesting question. And I agree with you that I would personally, in the context of today's civilization, I would not feel happy forcing a woman to eat kibrachs on Pesach just because I do. But I can only tell you that I've gone away for Pesach a number of times to scholar in residence. I'm not happy to go. Whatever the reasons are, this year I turned down many invitations because we make the Seder. Every other year we make the Seder. But one of the great joys of going away for Pesach is I can eat gebrachs and my wife can't stop me. But when we're home, she is, wow, chas v'chalila, I should put a little matzah into the soup.
So you're the boss now.
No. In today's day and age, I know where I am the boss and where I'm not the boss. Now, when it comes to gebrachs, I am not the boss. But that's Zolman Zangison. But anyway, this is powerful tshuva, fascinating the analogy to Mokum Shenahagol. Okay, let me go one step further. In the Sephardic world, there were poskim who achieved unbelievable authority. One of them, and these are names that every Sephardi knows, Reb Chaim Palachi. Reb Chaim Palachi was Shichmo Lamala Mikol Ha'am. And he wrote many svarim, and halacha lemaisa, I'm quoting from one of his svarim, I have it photographed in front of me, Moed Lechol Chai. By the way, all these rare svarim I was able to get from Rabbi Hutner, he would let me go into the Encyclopedia of Talmudical Library and Zirix, whatever I want, and they have a rabbinic library second to none. Today, that whole library has been moved to Yeshurim. Anyway, Moed Lechol Chai. Sifriyah HaLumim at Hebrew U, which they're supposed to build an old building for and all types of plans, they would have this forum. But it's much harder. They don't let you take it out and you have to Xerox it there. It's much harder to work with. Here, I could get the svarim, and it takes a long time for the svarim to reach you. In Rep Rabbi Hutner had, within minutes, the sefer was in my hands. Xerox machine, 1, 2, 3. So time-wise, it was much easier for me. I think, according to law, when these Sfarim came in from Europe, Hebrew U had first choice. Yad Rav Herzog had second choice. I think that was according to the law of the land, that the Sefer Yelumim has to have everything. So that's why I used Rav Chutna, but they certainly must have this as rare as it is. So he paskins la'alacha according to Simin Bet, subdivision, Chaf Gimel, v'ha'isha chol la'kufet ishtol, shelo tinha k'minik beit aviyo b'chumret Pesach. And he paskins like Rav Mizrachi, he paskins like the Tash Beitz, and makes it clear that she cannot be machmir, he can insist that she be mekel. In the next siman, siman chafdalin, he deals with legumes. And here you can see where he is a little bit apprehensive, meaning that sure, you can eat legumes on Pesach. Sure, that's your minhag. Certainly, there's nothing wrong with it. But the legumes have to be cleaned properly. And he's worried that if there's too much to clean, you will not do a proper job. So like it's a continuation of what he said a minute ago, that the man can eat legumes, the woman can eat legumes, but then he warns them that start cleaning the rice at least 3 days before Pesach. Check very carefully, and you have to be certain that by the time Pesach comes, all foreign substance, all foreign grain is removed. And look at what he says, for atzlut, if you're lazy about this, you're going to feel very bad on Pesach, machmat eisetakola, because you will have on Pesach an accident, and you will see that you have grain in the rice. And hazariz bezeh, and if you're really careful, v'chol hayad hamabel livdok harei zeh. The more hands you have checking, the better it is. And that's exactly the way we clean rice on Pesach. We had a double table, a big white cloth, three rabbis on this side, three rabbis on the other side. The rice was passed down, passed down, passed down. Six pairs of eyes check the rice. At the end, what's okay, went into a big pan, pot, whatever you call it, a sear, tremendous sear, where they cooked it, and then it was frozen. And I have to tell you, we sat around all day, what did rabbis talk about? Israeli politics, jokes on the political leaders. Believe me, there was not a word of Divrei Torah. And all our jokes, I'll never forget, 1 year we spent the whole year, again, you're not Israelis, you can't appreciate it. David Levy was becoming a famous politician. And we spent the whole day chatting about David Levy, and he knows nothing, and jokes, and if he opened this Gemara, he wouldn't know right sign. You know, he came, his mother dreamt he would be a rabbi. He was, and in Moroccan, his kids are all Shomer Shabbos, you should know. One of his sons-in-law is, one of his daughters-in-law is an American girl who made her husband totally frum, not just traditional. And whenever we would get together years later, I remind my colleagues who sat on me and laughed at David Levy when he was now foreign minister. I said, gentlemen, where are we today? And where is Sa HaChutz David Levy today? And boy, they all had to look down. All our jokes were in vain. Or as they say, he had the final joke on us. But you have to be careful. You're dealing here with beetle on Pesach, particularly if you don't cook it. Chas v'chalilitz b'mashehu. And atzlut leads to takalot. Okay, so what have we seen today? Let me reiterate. What have we seen today? Fine, I gave an introduction. I spoke about the time warp, which is very important. You can't judge a woman's mentality and a man's mentality of the 1400s, the 1600s, the 1700s, by the way we think today. But one thing we see from Tashbetz, from Rav Pinchas Yosef Mizrahi, from Rav Chaim Palachi, that the man can actually force the woman to take his kulat. What's fascinating is you can explain it for two reasons. One reason is Shalom Bayit, the other reason is Makom Shenahagu. It would seem to me if you follow the reason of Shalom Bayit, then he can force her. If you follow Makom Shenahagu, it's a little bit hard to say he can force her, so why do you care if she keeps a chumrah? But evidently the Shalom Bayit and the Makom Shenahagu have to be interlocked and interconnected. Gentlemen, you'll see when we pick up again, and I have to say next week there is no class on Sunday, it is Tzom Gedalia, but there'll be one final class next Monday, which will be our last class until after Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and all that goes with it. So this week, tomorrow is normal, next week is only Monday due to Tzom Gedalia. Now, tomorrow morning, Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYov Koach, I'm coming into Achar HaAm and how that gave birth to the Mizrahi and the problems the Mizrahi faced, which are problems that until today we have to deal with and don't have black and white answers. I quoted from Netanyahu. By now, Asher Palmer and his son Yonatan have been buried, and it breaks the heart, our battle over Hebron, which is the first part of Eretz Yisrael that we paid for. Kesef Male, Ovel LaSocher, we still are paying for it with lives, which is infinitely worse than only paying with money. I have a number of freebies to give away. First of all, this is the weekend's Makor Rishon. The Oman deals almost entirely with Haredim and the Medina. I have to say Aaron Rakefin is the proudest person in the world because a good deal of what is said here, I have said over the last years. And all my theories, it's like someone was listening to me, are right here. I remember I just live in a little office in Gruss, but I do have my hand on the pulse of what's going on in the Torah world. If anyone wants this, it's very, very fascinating. Secondly, this is a collector's item. This is a collector's item. The 1950s, it's 59, it's a time warp. It's an attempt to get people to keep Tarat Mishpacha in the United States of America. It's edited by Rabbi Mordechai Rabinovich. You'll see it's a very interesting little biography about his connection to what you call Yeshiva University. It's the halakhot of Mila, of Mikvah, and the psychological, medical reasons why it's so important. If anyone wants it, it's yours. Yitzchak, I think you'll be interested in that. And this, these are two early issues from the Hatnuali Adut Shel Torah. That's Torah Vavoda. Very fascinating articles. Israel 101, Halavai, everyone in the world should read this. It's about our fight for the land and why the land belongs to us. It attempts to create understanding across the world as the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, lighting a candle in a dark room. It's in English. Midei Chodesh B'Chodesho, if anyone's going into Chinuch, this is a fabulous monthly volume edited by my student, Rabbi Aryeh Weinberger. It deals with the month, the holidays, children, what you can teach them, things you can do with them. Rav Asher Fram, Yisachar Fram, excuse me, I'm mixing up Asher Weiss. Very interesting in concept here on why the Mir Yeshiva was saved. It's interesting to see the schut of the Rabbim sticking together. His divrei Torah at the end on a Torah's leader job is never over. Very fascinating. He's right on. Finally, if anyone wants Maneh Knisat Shabbat and Yetziat Shabbat, this has been given out in the shul where I said Slichat. Until we meet again tomorrow morning, Be'ezrat HaMatein Le'yav Koach, we should meet in health and happiness. Easy Slichat, Das V'Dadmah.